Mr. DeGuale.
Good morning, Your Honor. I would like to thank the court for the opportunity to present oral argument this morning. This case originated in January of 2008 when I, after working a period of 10 years for S.C. Johnson & Son, reported to management outside the tax department tax fraud that had been occurring within the company. To my surprise, I expected company management to correct the situation. Rather, company management immediately began in a cover-up scheme to conceal the fraud and, in fact, further perpetuated the fraud. This activities went on to form retaliation, and that accumulated in my termination, which occurred a year later. Subsequently, in January of 2010, I filed a RICO cause of action in the Federal District Court. The trial judge at that time dismissed the cause of action, claiming that there was not a pattern requirement satisfied under RICO. This court previously has heard this case and decided that indeed there is a pattern requirement that is satisfied based upon the enactment in Sarbanes-Oxley of Title 18, Section 1513, subparagraph E. The case was under remand. Sorry?
Wisconsin trial court found on the basis of that Kirkland and Ellis lawyer's affidavit that SCJ had not engaged in any tax fraud or other criminal activity of any sort. Now, so that was an expert report by this tax lawyer. Did you put in any counter affidavit of another expert or what? How did you meet the Kirkland lawyer's affidavit?
I was not afforded the opportunity to provide the affidavit due to discovery restrictions imposed by the court.
Well, I can't hear you. You have to speak up.
I was not afforded the opportunity to provide any affidavits to the receiving
court.
Well,
what do you mean by afforded the opportunity?
There was discovery restrictions that were imposed by the Racine litigation that were fundamentally unfair. And in fact,
I don't understand. So the Kirkland lawyer was permitted to give an affidavit. Now, why weren't you permitted to submit an affidavit?
Based upon the circumstances which makes the Racine litigation, state litigation, fundamentally unfair. The judge involved recused himself from the litigation without explanation. The only plausible explanation is an admitted bias. The judge hastily scheduled hearings, and in fact, the judge settled the judgment.
No, be specific. The Kirkland lawyer presents an affidavit. That's introduced into evidence. Now, and you say you were not given an opportunity, you didn't have an opportunity to submit an expert report countering the Kirkland report?
That is correct.
What does that mean, wouldn't have an opportunity? They file something?
The Wisconsin Court of Appeals said that you had an ample opportunity, but you simply defied the state court's orders on how to proceed. Now, I understand you agree with that, but you've got a finding by the state's appellate court that the problem was your own conduct in litigation rather than the adequacy of the procedures. How does one respond to that?
Your Honor, I would respectfully disagree. The adequacy of the procedures is of issue. The problem why
I understand, but you've litigated. No, we've got a double dose of litigation. The state court found it. State trial court found against you on merits. You then argued to the state appellate court that there were deficient procedures, and the state appellate court rejected the argument that there were any procedural problems. So you have to persuade us to ignore the finding of the appellate court as well as the finding.
Yes.
Of the trial court.
And I believe you should
was
do
there
exactly
some
that.
Procedural defect in the way the appeal was conducted?
Specifically to the Wisconsin Court of Appeals, yes. And in fact, I filed with you, Your Honor, a petition for a motion for hearing of redetermination and a hearing in blanc. The trial, the Court of Appeals has specifically excluded consideration of relevant facts and, more importantly, has constructed facts that simply do not exist in the record. And I ask that you would review that detailed brief that has been filed with you, which will show precisely why the Court of Appeals decisions should not be followed. You mentioned the Kirkland and Ellis opinion.
But you never have obtained an affidavit from an expert.
I, was in the process of doing so, but the discovery restrictions prohibited me from fully completing that. And in the meantime, while those discovery restrictions were...
There can't be any... There would be prohibition against your just obtaining an affidavit? That's different from submitting it in the litigation.
An affidavit is based upon an assertion of fact.
Yeah, but couldn't you go and find an expert who would say that, you know, SCJ had engaged in fraud, then you'd have the affidavit. You filed a lot of stuff with us, right? You could have filed your affidavit with us if you've gotten an affidavit. As it stands, there's nothing to counter the Kirkland lawyer's affidavit.
My argument is one cannot blindly follow that affidavit from Kirkland and Ellis.
Well,
it's
we have to follow it if nothing else was put there.
Isn't it a basic fundamental legal analysis be questioned? Clearly, Internal Revenue Code Section 6672 imposes an affirmative obligation on all U.S. taxpayers to be truthful in their representations to the IRS. Kirkland and Ellis cites absolutely no legal authority in its opinion. What authority, legal authority, a case, a regulation, a statute, specifically supports the opinion? The opinion is full of caveats, and furthermore, if you read the Kirkland Ellis opinion, which has been provided to this court, it's simply utter nonsense.
What's nonsense? I'm looking at it. What is nonsensical about it?
Well, what's of great interest here, Your Honors, explain why did S.E. Johnson repay the $7 million to the IRS 6 days following my termination? Kirkland & Ellis' memo somehow suggests that these wrong numbers magically transform themselves to become correct numbers, but then never goes on to explain, well, if they're now correct, why did you pay the money back? I mean, where's that subsequent transformation where they now transform from being correct and back into wrong? Why did you pay $7 million back to the IRS?
Well, see, that's why you should have filed an affidavit that explained that, because courts are not clairvoyant. We can't just sort of see that affidavit from Kirkland and on our own it apart and figure out what it means and why the numbers are different or why they've been converted. We need something else to look at. And
The issue was...
And you still haven't told us why you couldn't give it. You weren't prevented by the court to provide that affidavit. You were given a deadline. You didn't meet the deadline.
The proceedings were fundamentally unfair, as discovery was not allowed. What evidence could I possibly provide to the court when I was not allowed, through discovery restrictions, to obtain the evidence to show the court this is the mistake and this is why the actions that occurred are unlawful? How is that possible? It's nothing more than me making a statement.
No, you get an expert. You show the expert to Kirkland.
That isn't precisely what I tried to do, and we were in the process of working on that. But for some reason, the state court judge summarily jumped in and hastily scheduled a summary judgment motion hearing, which I will note, he did not even satisfy Wisconsin statutes on notice requirements. Notice requirements in the local rules require at least a 20-day notice. The judge only gave 16 days. Clearly. First of all, I ask you to take a look at, were the discovery restrictions appropriate? Clearly they weren't, because there's nothing in the record that exists to justify the imposition of discovery restrictions. I reserve my remaining time for rebuttal.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. DeGuayle. Mr. Schreiner.
May it please the court. I'm pleased that the court has seen the decision of the Wisconsin Court of Appeals from last month, because that was the primary matter that I wanted to draw the court's attention to here. This is a case, the legal issue arises under the full faith and credit statute, 1738, the requirement that the district court and this court give full faith and credit to the judicial proceedings of the Wisconsin courts as those Wisconsin courts would interpret them. All of the issues that Mr. DeGuayle has talked about here today were issues that he raised in the Court of Appeals of Wisconsin. The Court of Appeals carefully reviewed the record and I think very carefully responded to each of the points that were made today, explaining, I think it's in paragraph 15, for example, the story of the expert. SCJ did submit.
Well, what about Mr. DeGuayle's point about the $7 million repayment?
I have no idea, Your Honor.
Excess taxes?
I have no idea, Your Honor. All I know about it is that Kirkland and Ellis gave an opinion that this was not tax fraud. Mr. DeGale.
Yes, I know, but it's opinion. I don't think it mentions the $7 million.
Your Honor, all I know is that Mr. DeGale had an expert, that he hired an expert with the assistance of the district judge who extended the time to allow him to do it, that expert was given the information that he said would be sufficient for him to form an opinion on whether or not Kirkland and Ellis' opinion was correct, and that he was then told by Mr. DeGale not to open that file and not to do the work. That's why he didn't have an expert opinion when the time came for him to counter Kirkland and Ellis' expert opinion.
My question is, what is that $7 million about?
I don't know, Your Honor. I don't know it at that level of granularity. All I know is that it was a sufficient basis on which the trial court in Wisconsin, affirmed by the Court of Appeals of Wisconsin, whose opinion itself is entitled to full faith and credit, determined that there was no tax fraud committed. I'm not a tax lawyer. I'm not here to tell you why it is that the Kirkland and Ellis lawyer determined that there was no tax fraud in the case. That's all there was before the court for determination, and that's the determination that they made. So under the analysis that Wisconsin follows in doing its collateral estoppel, or what it now calls issue preclusion, the only question here is whether or not this was a fundamentally fair procedure. All the points that Mr. DeGale has made to you this morning.
I didn't get anything about fundamental fairness. What is that about?
I don't know, Your Honor. I mean, that's, you know, I've never known. I heard it in an earlier argument today, too. What's fundamental fairness? It's this notion that if it is issue preclusion as opposed to claim preclusion, and by the way, the claim against SCJ itself is precluded by claim preclusion. If it's an issue issue preclusion, you go through all the standards. Is it the same set of facts? And, you know, was there an opportunity for appeal and all that sort of thing? And at the end, the judge has to say, is there something fundamentally unfair?
Yes, well, that's the puzzle, because the factors seem exhaustive, and yet the fundamental fairness is then tacked on at the end.
It is, and it doesn't make a lot of sense to me. But what I will say is that all the factors that he points to as making this unfair for issues that he then raised to the Wisconsin Court of Appeals, every single one of them. And the Wisconsin Court of Appeals said there was nothing unfair about it at all, that the judge bent over backwards to help him, and this was a fair proceeding. And so I look at it from the point of view of what would another Wisconsin trial court do if Mr. DeGale were to go file this case there, knowing that not only has judgment been entered against him on the issues of tax fraud and retaliation, but that the Court of Appeals has affirmed it in the face of the very arguments he now wants to argue are evidence of fundamental unfairness. And I think the answer is clear. I mean, this judgment of the Wisconsin Circuit Court, affirmed by the Wisconsin Court of Appeals, is entitled to full faith and credit. Certainly the district court here, whose application of those fundamental fairness standards is entitled to deference, reviewed on an abuse of discretion standard, certainly can't be thought to have abused its discretion in so finding. I have nothing further unless the court has more questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Schreiner. Anything further, Mr. DeGuelle?
First of all, let's make it very clear. This case never considered any of the facts or the underlying law involved. It was S.C. Johnson's intention to specifically lose this case in procedural grounds, and that's precisely what happened here. The issue of fundamental fairness was fully briefed with the federal trial court. The facts in this case overwhelmingly demonstrate fundamental fairness was lacking in the state court litigation. Perhaps the strongest indication thereof is the discovery restrictions, with no basis to support imposing discovery restrictions. That, as the trial court brief indicates, is precisely the consideration that must be made when determining if the underlying issue preclusion case should apply because it was fundamentally fair or not. Discovery is one of those considerations. Kirkland and Ellis memo, Your Honor, does indeed mention the $7 million issue. It mentions that S.C. Johnson paid the money back, is what is mentioned. I do want to point out there is more than one version of that memo, but this court has been provided with all the versions for its review. My expert specifically stated to the Racine trial court that he needed to work directly with me because I am an accountant that understood the book accounting aspects of this tax fraud. Without being able to obtain my assistance, he couldn't proceed. And rather than address this issue, the court immediately jumped and hastily scheduled a summary judgment motion. I asked the court to send this case back to the federal trial court with a decision that it was fundamentally unfair to apply issue preclusion. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. Case is taken under advisement.